Welcome back to the Mediocre Alaskan Podcast. This is episode 200. Finally got here. My guest today is from Western Contours. His podcast can be found on all the major podcast outlets. His name is Guy Duplanchet. He is from California, and we're going to talk about a lot of different stuff. And we're going to do a dual recording, so he's going to use this on his platform, and I will release it on mine as well. So first time we've done this before, so we'll see how it goes.
So we're on with the host of the Mediocre Alaskan Podcast and author of the A Miserable Paradise, Jeff Lung, out of Ketchikan, Alaska. How'd I do on that, man?
That's perfect. That's exactly right.
Good deal, man. Happy to have you on, brother. Looking forward to sharing some Alaska info, right? It's kind of a intimidating place when people start looking at hunting. Its size, its weather, some of the critters. But yeah, interested in going back and forth. We're going to kind of dual podcast this, I guess, and talk a little bit about whatever you ask me, and then we'll get into some Alaska.
That sounds good.
I'll let you kick it off, or how you want to roll.
Yeah, well, I've actually never done the dual recording type thing, which is kind of fun, but most podcasts ends up being a conversation anyway, so it doesn't really matter who the host is and who the guest is, so it's good. So what episode are you on with your podcast?
Oh, dude, I think I'm somewhere in like the mid-teens, 213, 215, somewhere in there.
Nice. This is 200 for me, so... A fellow, I don't know if it's a monument or a mark, but it means that there's been at least 200 hours of whatever I'm doing out there.
Wait. You know it's more than 200 hours.
I've had some shorter ones. When I did, I've done some solo ones. When I do the solo ones, I kind of go to 10, 15 minutes just to kind of keep in the habit of doing it. You know, there are some people who they've done a couple episodes and then they can't get a guest, and so they end up falling off, and then the habit becomes not doing it, and so it ends up, so I wanted to make sure I stayed with it, that I followed through. So I had some shorter ones, but I also have a couple that are pretty long, so you're probably right, it's probably more than 200 hours.
Yeah, so how does that work on your side when you do the solo ones? Because I've done a couple, man, and my intent is always to sit down. And I wanted to do like one or two of those a month, right? Because I'll get fired up about something, or I'll see something and I'll write something down. And when I sit down to record about it, unless I do it in the moment, it never comes out the way I wanted it to. So I fail on most of those.
Yeah, I think it's I write some notes. I'm a freelance writer too, and I do two columns a month for the Juno Empire. So I kind of have things pretty much always going around in my head, and I'm almost constantly writing some sort of notes down. So when I do sit down to record the short ones, I have, you know, two or three maybe points that I try to get through. But it is different not having anybody to bounce things off, and so sometimes you'll finish it out and think, man, that wasn't really a refined thought. That was just kind of what I felt in the moment. But sometimes that stuff can be really good, and people kind of like that honesty. But you know, it is what it is. I'm sure some of those are not very good, but some of them I think I make some sense. But
that's the hard part, is being your own judge.
Oh man, listening to how I sound. And have you gone back and listened to some of your first podcasts?
Oh no, absolutely not. Absolutely not, man. That's the nice thing about it too, right? Is you just, at least for me, is just plug along, enjoy the conversations, enjoy the people, and you know, don't look back, just keep going. And I figured there would be a growth and an evolution, if you will, in the hosting and conversation. So I hope that comes through as I'm recording these.
Yeah, I think there could be a good part of going back and listening, because then you can see that improvement. Mm-hmm. And one of the main things when I started, and I've said this a whole bunch of times on the podcast, is people were saying that your 100th episode is going to be way better than your first one, but you have to get there. And if you're too critical of yourself at first, then you're never going to get there. And that goes for anything. You know, if you fail at elk hunting, or you fail at riding, or you fail at whatever, then, and you stop, it's, you got to get through all that stuff. You got to get through those rejections. You got to get through those failures, because all that stuff is going to lead to the growth that you want.
Yep, absolutely. Couldn't agree with that more.
So you're in California.
Yes, sir.
And I got to tell you, I was looking up some stats from, I lived in California for 10 years when I was teaching out of college. And I drew the D3 through 5, which I don't think you draw that. You can just get that, right?
Right.
And it looked like there were 31,000 tags and an 11% success rate. And I looked at that area of D3 through 5, those areas, and it's a pretty large area of California.
Oh, it's huge.
And I kind of equated it to where I live in southern southeast Alaska, and it's like Prince of Wales Island, which is where I grew up, and then Revillagigedo Island, which is where I currently live, and then Gravina Island. So it's these three islands that are pretty large, but that's such a minuscule part of Alaska as a whole. So I just kind of wanted that comparison. I'd never really done that before. So what constitutes a large area in California is actually pretty small compared to Alaska. But
I'm sure.
I'd never really thought about that before. I've just compared, and I've kind of unfairly compared hunting in California to up here, because it's just crazy. But what's your primary target when you're down there hunting?
You know, I'm the last few years I've been almost 100% focused on elk. And it's getting worse, right, as I progress through my pursuit there. But typically, man, you know, we start off with a zone, and you can get primarily it's a coastal zone, right? It runs about, I always say about a third of the balance of the state between A zone north and A zone south, from the 5 freeway north of the Bay Area all the way to LA County, the northern LA County line. So I'm not sure how familiar we are. You are with that, but I mean, it is a huge footprint of the state, and that it's typically blacktail habitat. So that's always a fun hunt. It's the longest hunt that I have in the state. Hmm. And then we'll do like a local either sex tag, and chase muleys on that. I don't really focus on draw, too much here for our deer. Not that we don't have really good opportunities. If you look at, like, you know, about where you were talking in that Eastern Sierra, you got the X zones, which are phenomenal zones, but I just I would rather have extended seasons and a ton of opportunity to be out on the mountain than shortening it up and, you know, having a 3-week season where I can burn, you know, only a week maybe to go to this premier zone. So my focus is just a lot of time in the woods and blacktail, and then that blacktail zone we can get into pigs. And so, you know, there's a couple of opportunities to run dual tags while you're rolling through there.
I've really been curious about the pig thing. I got the D3 through 5 for 2 years when I was in California. I saw one terrified doe, and that was it. But it just seemed just so crazy that I didn't pursue much. But now that I've moved back to Alaska, I've seen that one of the big ticket items is the pig hunting.
Oh, man, it's so much fun. You know, it, and for me, it goes, and I've always seen it go through cycles. So I tend to say 5 to 7 years, depending on, you know, drought, no drought, things like that. And we're in that uptick cycle right now. Last year in our A zone, we're hunting basically inland central coast, if that makes any sense. And in about 3 or 4 weekends, we counted 250 pigs.
Oh, geez.
And there was about 3 groups that made up, you know, that amount of pigs. And it's really a fun pursuit, man. I mean, it's an inexpensive tag. You can hunt them year round. And if you can get into them, it's a great time. They're a wily little creature, right? So they don't stop moving. They're hard to predict. And when you find them, and you could have some, you know, you could have some fun putting the bacon on the table, so to speak.
Nice.
Literally and figuratively. But they're a great animal to pursue.
You said inland valley. Where was that?
So I said inland central coast. So
inland central coast. Usually,
yeah, it kind of doesn't make sense, right? But we're hunting just inside the 5 freeway, almost smack dab in between the 5 freeway and the coast. in Central California. And it's just, it's been phenomenal. There's a couple of good herds of deer. Like I said, the last couple of years, man, the pig numbers have just skyrocketed. Mm-hmm. But if you get a chance to chase those things down here, man, I'd jump on it.
I'd heard, was it Paso Robles is kind of a spot that I know someone who'd gone down there that was pretty good for pigs. And then I'd heard the same thing about the deer hunting there. And then the Eastern Sierra, definitely. And then those X units up north.
Yeah, if you could draw an X zone, it'd be awesome. You know, it's just trying to, you know, as a resident, they're like, you know, I'm saying at this point with point creep, 6 to 7 years. But it's where we have our true migratory herds. And there's some monsters, man.
Yeah.
Some monsters. But the seasons are short, right? So, yeah. You know, we wait all year. So for me to just anticipate a 3-week season after waiting months and months and months, it's just never been my gig. I would rather, you know, like with the A zone, right? It starts in, well, this year it's starting a little later, but typically starts in August and then runs through October. So, I mean, you're talking, you know, months there, and you got 4 to 6 weeks of archery, and then it goes into general season. General season's any weapon. So if you bomb out an archery, you could chase them with a rifle, or you keep going with your bow there. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, it's just that extended opportunity is phenomenal. And like I said, you know, a third of the balance of the state for the most part, maybe just shy of, it just makes it, for a weekend warrior, it is the, in my opinion, the prime tag. Because you don't, you know, you're not looking at it starting one weekend and you got 2 weeks after that. And you know how life is, man. It breaks it up and you may miss a weekend. So now you've only hunted 3, 4, 5 days that whole season. Just to me is a waste.
Yeah. So what does hunting look like in 10 years, do you think? Another thing that I was thinking about, like from my perspective as someone living in Alaska, when you just hear the news, it sounded like the entirety of California was on fire. So I guess there's two questions. One is, how do the fires impact your hunting? And then two, going forward, what does it look like in 10 years? You mentioned point creep, fires, droughts. What do you got?
Well, we got a lot of OTC, right? So our OTC tags, and that's, like, again, that's what I chase is our OTC tags. In terms of fire, it's necessary. Mm-hmm. The problem here in the state is that we don't have any real management in terms of forestry, right? We're not doing controlled burns and things like that on the majority of the public land. So there's all this overgrowth. So when we get really big fires, you know, I actually welcome it. it's good for everything involved, right? In the ecosystem. Some of them are extremely bad because of the lack of management. In terms of controlling that vegetation. So what happens is you get into this really bad fire season, and then that area shuts down because of it. We, you know, start to see a little growth if we have a decent rainy year to follow all that, but a lot of it washes down. So, you know, it's a combination of no management, big fire, and then the ground can't sustain because it can't hold itself up, right? We have... And I think there's a misconception of California, you know, it is not flat, right? We have some monstrous mountains and a lot of steep, you know, hard to access terrain. So when that stuff happens, man, it's kind of a detriment that way. But I got to welcome it, right? I always see increase in numbers after the fires. You just see better habitat, better health in the herds. You can see it from the bucks. So it's awesome. In terms of in 10 years, man, if they stop the antes, if you will, I don't want to get into that too deep, but if they stop the special interest money flowing into, you know, pockets, and I think we're going to be, you know, we stand to be in a good position, right? They pretty much banned every angle on predator hunting that you could imagine. We're still able to hunt bear, but that's even looking grim. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of the not so distant future, you know, they tried to attack bear hunting last year again. Thank goodness that fell down, but you know, they're not going to stop. So mountain lion 92, I think, they took away mountain lion hunting. Mountain lion's currently on a temporary endangered list, which is phenomenal to me with the numbers that we see now. No bobcat hunting, no trapping, and then no, you know, with the bears, we only have a fall season. We never meet our quota. And they're going to keep pushing to protect the bears. And if there was a need for it, you know, by all means, but the numbers we see, we haven't met our quota. They bounced that quota up to 1,700 some years back. And I don't think we've hit that number in over, you know, a decade, at least. It's a lot of mismanagement, man, across the board.
Well, you have a lot of people who are doing that stuff from afar. They don't really understand what the reality is. It's from inside their laptop, and they want to have some sort of purpose. And sometimes people find purpose in being angry or combative, or, you know, this is my role, this is my mission, this is what I have to do. And you just don't take into account how complex things are.
You know, you couldn't have said it better. They, you know, they're coming from the heart, and I think they have great intent, but it's no real scientific data that backs anything else. You know, it's all emotional. It's feeling based. And we've seen it again, going back to the mountain lions, man. I could count on one hand, you know, when I was a kid, you know, backpacking or fishing, how many mountain lions I saw. And in the last, I'm going to say 10 years, if I don't see two or three a season just walking around, I'm surprised. The numbers are just astronomical. We're having more, you know, cat people conflicts and pets getting nabbed. And it's just what happens to the deer. You know, they don't look at the big picture and how that ecosystem is affected by too much of one thing, et cetera.
Yeah. I think it was Joe Rogan's podcast that was talking about a lady who had, I don't know if it was alpacas or if it was llamas, and that was her livelihood. And a cat just wiped them out. And she wanted to get, or almost all of them, so she wanted to get a permit to trap or kill or otherwise, you know, eliminate this thing that was killing her llamas. And the amount of uproar, like, she got death threats, and she's just trying to protect her livelihood. But it's just so, it's
bizarre.
It is bizarre. It's crazy just that people are that, can't even say, oh. I mean, there probably are people. There probably are people who are like, I want to save the cats. Oh, wait. Okay, I changed my mind. And you don't hear from them. You only hear from the people who just double, triple, quadruple down on that stuff. And it doesn't matter what the facts say. It doesn't matter what the science says.
No. It's amazing. Well, I mean, and you think about it, right? If they're coming from an emotional standpoint, right, that animal's life, when that lady said, hey, I want to protect my livestock, and then people send death threats her way. I mean, what is that? You know what I mean? It's like, that just doesn't make an iota of sense to me. I mean, it's like, wait a minute. You're going to threaten her life. She's lost her livelihood for all intents and purposes. It's the weirdest take on things, man. It's like, how do you rationalize or justify, you know what I mean? It's like Jeff Lund wants to shoot a grizz that's killing his livestock in Alaska. You know, he has this big brown bear on his property three times a week, and it's wiping out his livelihood. If you even mention wanting to do something, they're, you know, I hope your family dies. I hope the bear hangs you on the wall, blah, 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 blah. It's craziness, man.
It's so unbelievably irrational, and it doesn't play by any sort of rules. Like, there are people who are reasonable, who you can explain things to, and they could say, oh, boom, I didn't know that. But the irrational people are the ones that, like, if you go to court, not that I've ever been on trial, but it's the burden of the prosecution to prove that the defender did the bad thing. But as hunters, it's like, we have to prove, but we're on the defense. Like, no, you have to prove that what we're doing is wrong. Like, you can't just say this and make us defend ourselves. It's like, wait, this is for you to evaluate the facts, then accuse us of stuff and say why we shouldn't do this. Not this emotional, and then defend that we're using science. It's crazy.
Wow. Well, I mean, and to a point, right? And I don't know how this parlayed in my head, but we have kind of played into that, right? Because for a long time, we didn't want to give an explanation. We didn't want to have to tell the whole story. We didn't want to have to talk about conservation and biodiversity and things like that. We just wanted to say, this is what the heck I do. If you like it, fine. If not, then, you know, piss off type thing. And I think it's, you know, it's to the point now where it's biting us. And then the people that are fighting against us, that have the influence and the money and understand what we do, but don't like it, they're not going to take a rational approach. They're going to jump in and get those people and tug on those emotions and use everything that we've done, be it a, you know, a bad social media post or, you know, some, that anomaly guy, right? The guy that's running around in the 62 Chevy with the beer cans empty in the back, you know, doing something stupid with an animal that he killed, you know, that's the stuff that, that they're using against us. So I think we've played to that to a point.
Yeah. I think we've instigated a lot of it. We've done ourselves a lot of harm by not representing it. And there was a time where I didn't really, wasn't that I was ridiculous, but it didn't really occur to me how important it is to be an ambassador of that. And it's not just a matter of, I can do this, it's my right, and I, you know, and then you have to just deal with it. I'm going to be in your face about it. Being combative, then, that's not the way to get people to be convinced that what you're doing is okay, let alone right.
Right.
And I think,
well, it's a rather new phenomenon, right? I mean, it's not something that we've dealt with before. We would take a 35 millimeter picture and share it, or we'd take that cell phone shot. We'd share it amongst our friends and family and, you know, our groups. And I don't think the thought process was there when this social media started to become as popular and as big as it is. We thought nothing wrong. Hey, I'm following Jeff, Jeff's following me. He hunts, I hunt. And then when that stuff started, you know, being shared across all these lines and hashtags and things of that nature, we didn't know. In our, you know, defense, we didn't know it was going to take that turn. You know what I mean? So this is a rather new phenomenon that we're all, you know, that we're all learning to deal with. The problem is that it seems like our learning curve is a little bit steeper than it should be with what we're up against.
Yeah. In a similar light, how do you think that social media has kind of changed us as hunters, like within our own user groups?
That's an interesting question. Man, that's a loaded question.
Because on the good side, you know, it connected myself and you. You know, just look at someone else on, hey, we're doing the same thing. It's different areas. Let's talk about it. This is great. You can connect yourself to a lot of different opportunities and hunts, and it can be totally beneficial and fun, kind of, and motivating, but can also have some other effects.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of us, right? I mean, the divides that I've seen us strike, because of, call it the market, is something that I don't think we would have seen. But it, you know, back to what you said, the connection, right? I don't care what kind of camo you wear. If you're, you know, a responsible, ethical guy, you know, and you're representing hunting in the best light possible, or what you think is the best light possible, it's great. You know, the doors have opened. You know, there's people that feel like they are, I'm in California, right? So there's not hunters jumping out of every store, you know what I mean? So the connection to be like, oh man, there's this community out there and I'm a part of it because of social media is exceptional. It's phenomenal, right? And then you meet people locally because of social, you know, I might know four guys from the range, two guys from the pro shop, but now I know 25 guys that are in Southern California that hunt because of social media. So yeah, in that respect, it's great. But watching us create lines in the sand in our demographic, and we're already up against so much. I mean, it's kind of a weird, you know, that battle for likes or, you know, double taps or whatever the heck that is, or you don't like, you know, the fact that I hunt with a compound and you're this, you know, super trad guy, or don't like the boots I wear or the camo I wear. I just, that kind of stuff is just, it's as bad and as confusing as the irrational folks that want to hang you on the wall when you talk about hunting, you know?
Yeah, I think it's pretty unfortunate that not everybody's life can involve the outdoors. And so they look forward to those 2 weeks out of the entire year, and they're otherwise just kind of feeding themselves with whatever they can get their hands on. A lot of times it can be just negative. They want to be like in the industry somehow. And so it just, it's not real. And they project someone that they wish they were rather than who they actually are or actually make things happen. But, you know, there's stuff year round. Like you're in California and you're still, there's still opportunities to do things outside year round.
And in terms of hunting, I mean, think about it. I could hunt pigs 24/7 here. As many tags as I want to buy, I can go get, you know, getting out there and looking for those pigs. You know, that in itself is outdoor recreation. Take a fishing pole. Because they're not easy to find on public land. And when you do, you got a honey hole, man, I guarantee you're going to hit it as often as you can. You know, and then look at California, right? From the ocean to the mountains in literally with good elevation, you're talking about 45 minutes and you can be, you know, 9,000 feet, 8,000 feet and snowboarding the same day as you surf, right? That sounds so cliche when I say it to myself, but it is an actual possibility here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. There's the discrepancy too between I can regurgitate the brochure, but do I actually live it? And if we don't actually live it, then that can wear on people. You know? I teach high school, and so kids are choosing colleges, and they say, oh, this one has this and this and this and this. I say, well, how much of this stuff are you likely to do?
Right.
Because everybody can say the best stuff. Ketchikan is great. Oh, we can hike and we can fish and we can kayak and we can do whatever. But if you're not, if you're spending most of the winter inside by yourself and during the spring, same thing, or you're inside watching Netflix or on social media looking to stir things up, you're not living the brochure that you say you are, and you're lying to yourself. And I think it's an important thing to connect ourselves to people who are doers, and it reminds us to actually do rather than just go online and pretend to be something that we're not.
And I tell you what, when you're doing, the value in just going online and pretending is, it's diminished, you know, greatly. You look at it as a waste of opportunity. You know what I mean? It drives, like I have a platform, right? So it's hard not to with the platforms because it is it's free marketing, right? It's connection to listenership. It's connection to more guests, et cetera, et cetera. But man, it is one of the hardest things that I have to do on a daily basis is spend an amount of time on there. Now, when I'm having it, let me caveat that, right? If I'm having conversations with folks and we're enjoying our outdoor experience or building each other up, if you will, I absolutely love that. And I think there should be more of it. But man, just that time on there, if I didn't have to do it, I would not have a flipping social media.
Yeah. Every year there is at least a couple students who, when I'm talking about realness and social media and whatnot, and I say that, you know, it's not good. It's not beneficial to be on there all the time. Compare yourself to other people. There's always a kid or two. So, well, Mr. Lund, don't you have social media? I'm like, yeah, but it's different. And then I'm like, I know. And that sounds exactly like what an adult would say, but here is the difference. Like using it for marketing, like I have to, it's a free platform for marketing. So if I just throw that off, you know, if people don't know that I've written a column, I'm not marketing from the column, then I don't have worth with the newspaper. And if we have to go through cuts or whatever, then it, you know, it's not going to happen. I'm going to be cut. So you have to market yourself. I'm producing some sort of product for other people to consume. So I have to market that. It's not a matter of just putting nothing out there or just being a straight consumer without producing any sort of positive content that might positively impact or bring value to someone's life.
I mean, you know, just you go through your page and you know, for me, right, an outsider looking in, Alaska is one of those places that I want to end up on a hunt. So I can go through that page and look at all the possibilities of Alaska, right? There's some value to that. Read the article. And a lot of what we see with, you know, at least down here with Alaska, right, is like my wife watches all those Alaska shows, man, and I can't think of the name of them. But like you said, sitting inside all winter, everything I see is like, men and guys, they're working way harder than I'd want to year round.
Yeah.
But I don't know, man. That's social. There's good and bad with anything. It's just how much you put into it and want to take away from it. If you just find all your value, your self-worth via social media, I'm sorry. There's so much more to you than that. You know, it's, I'm not going to say any more than that. Some of it's a little sad, but
yeah. Well, I'll leave it at that. There is a whole bunch of content makers in the industry, not just consumers. So how do you find space in such a cluttered field? Like, my angle for the podcast about Alaska was, I mean, everyone comes up here and they film something about Alaska or they do a podcast about the time that they went up there. There weren't a whole lot of podcasts by Alaskans about Alaska. And I went with the angle with, hey man, I'm not trying to be an expert. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert. So mediocre Alaskan, you know, pretty easy. Now just a matter of connecting me to other listeners. But still, you're looking at, there's a ton of podcasts about hunting and outdoors out there. So how do you find space in, you know, such a cluttered field of podcasts and writing and videos and everything else?
I don't know if I found space. I don't know if I found anything. I've created my own, I think, to a point. It was me looking for something more out of, you know, what I was hearing. Whether I create more or not, I don't know. But I know the value that I get in the connections and friendships, if you will, that I've made through this platform, right? When you talk about, you know, like we said earlier, right, that the community, our demographic, and just the ability to share these stories and these conversations is kind of where I set myself. Thank goodness there's people willing to listen to it. Right. Sometimes it still amazes me. But I don't think I've found anything. I think I've just, you know, kind of carved out my own little spot of it. Just, you know, just like you have, just trying to figure out, you know, you're interested in something and what do? Right. You just do what you can to make something happen and do what you see, you know, or what you want to do, how you see fit.
Yeah.
You know, finding space. And I mean, in turn, you're talking industry. I think I'm far from that. That'd be great, right? To monetize and, you know, really monetize it and make those kind of leaps and bounds. But it is, it's a very difficult task, right? You got to bring a lot to the table.
Yeah. Randy Newberg talks about this a lot as far as, like, rather than all taking our slice of the pie, making the pie bigger. And he talks about that with regards to like resources and the amount of elk and the amount of deer. But I was talking with Tyler Friel, who does Tundra Talk, great podcast, and writes for Outdoor Life. And we're talking about the same thing goes for like content making. It's make the pie bigger rather than nice scratch for our own. That means that you can be who you are, be honest. And like you said, create your own thing.
Right.
Which then if people want to listen to that, that's great. If you want to find a podcast about elk hunting or mule deer hunting or whitetail hunting and someone's just talking about how great they are, there's a ton of those. But as far as like content that, you know, make you think and there's some sort of takeaway, like there aren't as many, but everyone has a different angle to the same sort of thing.
Absolutely. And that's the best ones, right? When you know it's just like for me, right? I'm a dude in a garage. So, but again, man, it's just, you know, it's just building our community or building our demographic up and presenting us in the best light that you can, that I can. And I mean, even just, you know, what we're doing here, right, is, you know, sharing an episode, two guys that have a podcast, talk hunting, you know, banter back and forth. I mean, that to me is, you know, there's that pie getting bigger, right? Here's another slice. And I've done a lot of those where, you know, it's another podcast and those are some of the funnest episodes, man. There's no intimidation. Guys can just go back and forth and you kind of used to the flow of things.
Yeah. What about, let's kind of get off that a little bit. Let's go to kind of hunting. That's kind of a good segue into the hunting buddy. Like what type of person do you like to to hunt with? Does it vary from hunt to hunt, or do you kind of like to
myself?
Solo? Yeah, I'm right there, man.
Dude, I've hunted solo for so many years, and a few years back, my buddy, he's from Ohio. He hadn't hunted in a while, and we started going together, and I enjoy those hunts, but I've always found more success in the woods by myself with just about everything I've chased. And not that I don't like those times. It's just, you know, maybe that's the selfish nature of it. It's good to share that time on the mountain, but there's something about the solitude, to me. And then there's something about only having yourself to blame, mm-hmm. right? In those situations, you can't, there's no excuses. There's nobody else making noise. There's nobody else putting themselves in the wrong position. There's just something about, you know, cliche, mano y mano with nature, right? It's me up against this. What can I achieve? How far can I go? And, you know, if I got it done, great. If I didn't, then I need to reflect and look at myself, and why I didn't get it done.
Yeah.
You know, and let's face it, I'm in Southern California, so it's not a subsistence thing, right? You know, it's not a matter of whether I eat or not, as it would be if I was, you know, up in Alaska in some of those areas. So there's nuances of, you know, I've been telling myself that this year, you know what, if I go out and I don't notch, you know, my elk tag, do I not buy any meat after my deer or pig run out? You know what I mean? Just to level it up a little bit. And then last year, my wife started going out with me, and that was phenomenal. She's not hunting. She's just being there. That experience there has been very eye opening to me to share that time with her. We've been married for 26, 27 years. And all the years I've been hunting, that was the first time in the woods, last elk season that she came out. So there was a little bit of something there. I'm hoping to get a bow or something in her hand here soon. To chase it, but yeah, that solo experience, man, I don't think there's anything like it.
No, and it's, I really like the opportunity to, I don't know, do everything on your own terms, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. And then there are times in a hunt where you just feel the impulse to go do something else. Like, I wanted to go up this ridge, but you know what, this one looks better. I'm going to do this right now. You don't have to worry about someone else who wants to follow the program, or I want to glass for longer, but well, now I guess we're going to go. So you don't have to worry about any of that sort of conflict. So whatever I feel like doing, I can do. And it's really nice. Yeah. And also, if the hunt was about, I just need some time away, just need to walk it off, then, you know, you can do that. So it can fill the purpose exactly how you want it.
Yeah. And then that, you know, I really like to walk around with that leap and then look attitude. And it's harder to do when someone with you, because not everybody's wired that way.
Yeah,
you know, like you said, you see that bridge and it's like, okay, that way there is probably doable and a bit easier, but I really want to just do that because I want to see if I could do it. Yeah. And that poses a challenge when somebody goes, dude, are you serious? Yeah. Well, I'll meet you around the backside.
Yeah. What was one of your most memorable hunts? Like, what was the moment that when you got done, you're like, dude, that was legit.
Elk.
all of every time, all the time?
Dude, elk is, there's just nothing like it to me, man. I mean, the social aspect of the animal, the ability to talk that animal in, and, you know, communicate with that animal. It's phenomenal. There's nothing that has struck a chord in the woods on the mountain to me like elk hunting. My big plan for 2021, actually it was 2020 that I pushed it, was, you know, Alaskan caribou for years. And with the way the elk been kicking my butt the last 4 years, I put that to the wayside, and I can't stop, man. It's all I think about. Yeah. It is absolutely all I think about, you know, even here at home. Like, I haven't hunted turkey. I've been supposed to have been on two or three pig hunts by now. And it's just like, how is that detracting from my elk pursuit? You know, I got stuff to learn. I got stuff to do.
Yeah.
Man, I can't get enough of just, you know, that animal is just phenomenal. It is. It's an amazing animal, man.
My fiance is getting her PhD at the University of Wyoming in Laramie. So I was down there 2 years ago for
screamers.
She had a general elk tag. And so she picked me up from the airport in Denver and we got out to the spot and we were camping. And in the middle of the night, I just hear one going at it. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, that's exactly, I mean, it's the most cliched, overused, but you cannot describe the feeling. It just goes right into your marrow.
Oh goodness. Yes.
And so I'm thinking, oh dude, it's on. And I look at my phone and it's like 11:30 PM. I'm thinking, no, I wanted it to be like 15 minutes before we could get out of the tent, you know? And so well, I'm not sleeping. There's no way I'm sleeping the rest of the night. Absolutely no chance with that bull doing its thing. And of course we didn't hear anything in the morning. And then we were walking down to where we maybe thought it was right as light was coming up and just going super slow. And I don't see any movement, but right on the edge of this clearing, all of a sudden a cow just appears.
Yeah.
And then another one. I'm thinking, what, how does this happen? Like that it's light enough to see, but I didn't see anything move. Were they just there the entire time?
Oh, they're amazing.
Yeah. Weren't able to get a shot. And then they took off and we didn't see anything. And she ended up shooting a really nice bull a couple months later on some friend's private ranch, which was crazy when she texted me and said, bull down. I was like, oh, sweet. You know, hopefully she got a nice, you know, a spike or something like a starter animal because she'd only killed a rabbit up to that point. And it's this awesome 5x5. I'm thinking, where? You didn't give yourself anywhere to go. That's not a starter bull. That thing is awesome.
That's a starter bull.
Yeah. So yeah, compared to other people, it's like,
yeah,
you know, I'd pass on that guy. But so yeah, it's totally, it's absolutely, I gotta go elk hunting. I'm so excited to get the chance to do that again.
Wyoming is something else, man. So 2018, I was in Wyoming and I pull up to my little camp spot and hop out. And I mean, I kid you not, man, I hadn't even put my foot on the ground and there's a few bulls just piping off. And the rest of the night, I think that night I got an hour and a half of sleep and all I could hear was bulls all night long, man. And the excitement, it was just, you know, it was that kid before Christmas thing. You know, you're just chomping at the bit the whole night. It's like, come on, go to sleep. And the more I try to go to sleep, you know, the more wide awake I was. And at some point I just passed out and an hour and a half later, the alarm went off and man, I couldn't get that, that camo on fast enough to get out in the woods.
It's nice
to have them. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say to have them screaming at you and they're, you know, 12, 13 yards away and just blowing. You want to talk about too, it goes, it meant it. It'll shake the marrow loose. It goes right through your body. It is soul piercing, man.
I want to experience that for sure. You mentioned the kid before Christmas thing, and it's so nice that as an adult to have something that brings that sort of life to you. Mm-hmm. It's not like that office space where you just hate your job and every day is the same and your boss sucks. But I think a lot of people are living that, you know, it's just a great opportunity to not live that and have something that is just so real and so visceral. It's unbelievable.
That's one of the things about hunting, right? I mean, you know, whatever your screaming bull is, right? Whether it's high country mule deer or caribou, you know, whatever it is, I can't imagine not having that thing to look forward to, that thing to work towards all year round, right? And then maybe that's part of it is that we only get a limited time per year. And that's really what keeps it fresh and, you know, exciting for us. I feel like I'm getting ramped up. And I got a little bit of the chills talking about it. But yeah, I can't imagine when I talk to people about hunting that don't hunt, it's one of the things I tell them, like try to draw that out. Like, what do you have that you just yearn to do year round? And a lot of people are like, well, nothing. You know, and I'm like, oh, I feel so bad for you because I can't imagine life without it.
Yeah. Yeah, people equate the killing of an animal to just the killing of the animal. And as much as, you know, people are willing to share the stories of the everything, the camaraderie, where it takes you, the physical demands, you know, so you have, you're going to be a healthier person because you're getting in shape to do these things, because that's your main goal, your mission. It's not, you know, for the mirror, it's to that, to put it to use in the field. And that's just such a real thing, but it's just skipped over by so many people who want to reduce it to the actual killing. But to have that as a motivator going forward is just, it's awesome.
It's awesome. And then think about the growth that we see, right? The growth throughout the year prepping for season. Then you get to season and you've worked to push yourself that extra mile or 2 miles, and what you watch yourself overcome through season and what you get through. And then that drive after season to go even harder than you did last year because it was a success for whatever reason, you know, tag notched or not, you know, and then it's just like this repeat of just making yourself better, more, you know, more accomplished in whatever the pursuit is, man. It's just, I can't wait, man. It's amazing. It's just an amazing thing.
The only way that you really get confidence is by doing things that are difficult. If you cower every time that something is difficult, you're not going to be confident. You're not going to be proud. You're not going to have those situations to potentially fail and either still be happy that you went through it, even though you failed, or succeed where you thought you didn't. And hunting provides that opportunity.
Yes, it
puts you on that edge and to that self-confidence that comes with it. During the pandemic, we had, well, still, I talk it like it's past tense, but we were at 50% capacity for a couple stretches in November when it's peak of the blacktail rut, and we didn't have school on Fridays. So half the kids would be on Monday and Wednesday. The other half was on Tuesday, Thursday. So Friday, no kids were in school. And I had kids who could show up to the office hours, but a lot of them would go hunting, or at least some of them went hunting. And I thought, what better way for a kid to be able to cope during the pandemic than going out with buddies or with family hunting? Because you're providing, it's purposeful. I couldn't be mad at kids who were skipping out on the office hours, because if they didn't have questions, they were doing their work, and they want to go do something real, that's great.
Oh yeah.
They would always, they'd share on either Monday or Tuesday how they did. And I had a terrible November. I didn't get a buck in November. And I had three of my students each got one on one day. And we saw them, and we hunted the same spot, and three of them got one. And then another one of my students got two in one day, and I'm just laughing. But I'm like, man, that's great. Yeah, the kids down south who were locked up, no school, that sucks for them. You know, the kids here are able to do something of that level of purpose. That was great.
Yeah, and unfortunately, you know, there's kids here, man, that have no idea that there's opportunities for them like that. You know, there's a couple spots that we have, and it has great animals, and I can see downtown Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. But they're, you know, call it 20, 25 minutes away as the crow flies, right? And there's people that don't even realize that there's deer and bear and mountain lions and access to wild places that close to all the concrete, steel, and glass.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you hope that the kids that are up there understand what they have when you see it from this view here. You know, it's just like, man, you guys are blessed beyond what you know. Because everybody, you know, you hear it everywhere you go. I want out of here. I don't like this place. I hate this place. I want to be here. I want to be there. And it's like, man, that is absolutely a gift.
Yeah. I had a kid write a paper when I was teaching in California. We're kind of doing a self-assessment end of the year, like kind of where you at. It was a sophomore when I was teaching sophomore English, and she wrote about how the thing she liked to do most in the world was to hunt elk with her dad. I thought, this is awesome. Great for this girl. But in like the next paragraph, she talked about how she didn't feel that she could share that with her friends because she fit into the cheerleader type stereotype. And she was afraid that if she told her friends that she liked to hunt, that they wouldn't accept her. And I thought, what an absolutely terrible, lonely experience that has to be, that you can't share who you are. And that it's with your dad too. Like, just what an amazing bond that you have with a parent that not a lot of kids have. And the fact that she felt too shy or too embarrassed to admit that. When she was a senior, she came up to me and said, you know, Mr. Lund, that paper I wrote sophomore year, I was like, oh yeah, I will never forget that. She said, well, I told my friends. I said, what'd they say? Yeah, they didn't care. I was like, see, you're worried about nothing. If they're really your friends, they're going to accept you for who you are. But, you know, not everybody gets that opportunity that has someone to kind of take them out. It could be fishing. It could be whatever it is. Just that camaraderie, that bond, that doing something that's real is so important.
Oh, it's huge. What area were you in down here when you were teaching?
I lived in Manteca.
Okay.
You heard of that? It's just south of kind of in between. It was right in between Stockton and Modesto.
It
was sandwiched between the like carjacking capital of the U.S. and the house foreclosure capital of the U.S. It was
that actually kind of surprises me, right? Because when you get up that, you know, we get up that high, that lifestyle is definitely more accepted. You see more of it especially when you get out of Southern California.
Yeah.
So I'm actually kind of surprised to hear that, because it's, you know, you get up into some of those smaller towns up there, man, and it's, hunting is, I don't want to say big, but you know, it's got a decent sized community, especially when you start talking waterfowl.
Waterfowl was pretty big. It was weird that Manteca, when I arrived, was like 35,000 people. By the time I left, it was about 60, and it was just a lot of Bay Area transplants, because a lot of people couldn't afford homes there, and so they moved out, and then they would commute in every morning, which was crazy. But you could kind of see that Manteca was losing its hold on that agricultural roots, because that Central Valley of California is not at all the stereotype that people think of. No. And there's a lot of that hunting and that farming and that ag, but it was kind of losing that identity, and it just became kind of, you know, I wouldn't say like Berkeley East, but you know, it was just different. And when you lose your roots and you lose that identity, it can be, well, you never get it back, but you lose a lot.
Mm-hmm. And I want to switch gears a little bit, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
Man, caribou. Man, I always joke around because my buddy, he started hunting up there. I think this is his second or third year. And for the longest, I've been saying, man, I want to go up and hunt archery caribou, and everybody tells me that's crazy, man, take a rifle. How difficult is that pursuit up there?
Well, I've only gone on one caribou hunt, and it was in March, and it was -30. It was the 40 mile herd, which is not just outside, about 100 miles outside of Fairbanks. My buddy that lives in Fairbanks drove us out, and we used some snow machines. And the herd is recovered, so it's a huge herd. You just got to find it, and then, got to. So people that go up there for archery do that in, like, August, September.
Mm-hmm.
And the terrain up there makes it pretty tough. And I have some buddies who've done that, and they've been successful. But you just have this rolling... It's rolling floating hills, tundra. But it's so... It's thick with tussocks in some areas, and there's just no way to kind of get close to some of these things. You see them, and they see you, and so it's just a matter of them being tolerant enough to allow you to get close enough into bow range, which is obviously the problem. So the first thing is being able to locate, because even though the 40-mile herd that I was hunting, there's over 80,000 animals in the herd.
Oh, wow.
They're not, like, scattered throughout everywhere, you know. It's just like these pockets of 400, 500, 600, but there's so much land, and there's, you know, you don't have roads going everywhere. So finding the animals is the first problem. And then the second one is, again, them being tolerant enough for you to make a sneak. And then if you're in an area where people can use four-wheelers, then there's going to be noise and potentially other people. And I guess that 40-mile herd hunt in August, September is just crazy, because there's just everyone goes up there, and if the caribou are near the road, it's just massive slaughter. So if you go up on the Hall Road to bow hunt, a lot less people, but then you're driving on this road and you can't get off it. So if something is 2 or 3 miles off the road. That's a long stock when you're exposed. So you're just kind of hoping that they're near the road. And then if they are, that you can stop, get out, make a stock. Because if you just post up, you might not see anything for, you know, 3, 4, 5 days. So you have to get lucky to be able to locate them and then tolerance for a stock. But, you know, again, like I, you know, guys like you would love being up there so much that it would be worth the experience. Like, so it's just the drive from Fairbanks up the Hall Road. You're talking about a long drive. What did I look at? I looked it up once, but you're essentially driving from, what would it be? It'd be like LA to San Francisco.
Oh, wow. So you're talking 11, 12, 13 hours.
Yeah. It's just, there's just so much space. It's unreal. And that's just to get to some of the areas that you're hunting. So if you're looking at, what unit is that? 24A. So you have to get up to Wiseman. Then you're driving in the Brooks Range. Like you're in that, this is the Brooks Range. This is the crazy stuff. And then once you get on the North Slope, like this is the North Slope. This is the tundra. This is it. You know, people spend a lot of money just to go up there and see it, but there's no roads that are spurring off this. So it's not like you get off the highway, the Hall Road, and then you go 4 miles down this spur and then take this other spur. Like the Hall Road is the only road. So, you know, you're going to see the people that are up there doing the same thing as you are. But if you can get away from people and you happen to see some caribou, then, you know, you got a shot.
Yeah, so I'm not sure where Keith is going. I think I want to say he's going into Anchorage. And the only thing I really remember about it is he said that because they were rifle hunting, so they had to be 5 miles outside of the pipeline. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, hiking across tundra. It looks like they're walking on a waterbed.
Yeah.
You know, to get 5 miles out. And he said, man, it's the hardest thing he's ever done is to pack that boot back
across that
ground.
Yeah. It's uneven and it's swampy. And then you got the tussocks. It's an absolute mess, but it's unlike anything you'll ever do.
Yeah. I'm itching to do it. The conflict is, I could do it in August, but I'm going to have to take some September time. You know what that means.
Yep.
To do it, but it's definitely a hunt. I have to at least give it a go, man.
Yeah.
You know, maybe because everybody I've talked to says, look, okay, hunt it with a bow. That's fine, but bring a rifle with you.
Yeah.
And that way you're not just SOL with, you know, with that cost of being up there and tags and things like that. And you can, you know, actually get something. Because everybody said the same thing. Getting within bow range is the trick.
Yeah. I just did a quick little Google thing here from Anchorage to Wiseman. So if you do fly into Anchorage and then like rent a car or something to drive up from there, it's 629 miles.
Oh, wow.
And Wiseman is on the southern edge of the Brooks Range. So people really do go up doing the Hall Road part. It's on the other side of it. So you're looking at another couple hours. But I think Wiseman or somewhere around there is the last spot for gas or civilization. But yeah, I mean, you're going through the Brooks Range. It's unreal.
That's another element too, right? I mean, you're not, this isn't, you know, a 13, 14 hour drive through sunny old Southern California. I mean, you're in God's country, Alaska. That's a whole other element, right? Is dealing with the things that can happen being so remote. It's one of the issues that I've found with it, especially when you're looking at, hey, buddy, you want to go on this hunt with me? You got to be committed unless you do something like, you know, a drop camp, you know, with an outfitter or something that flies you in.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough because there's a lot of people who aren't like used to that. They're used to maybe cold temperatures, but then the next day they're at a hotel or, you know, they can go back to the hotel. So they're miserable for a couple hours during the day. There's always like a contingency plan or a way that you can maybe not do it. But if you're out there, you're really out there and the commitment is so much different. And things can go sideways pretty quick. And I'm always a pretty casual or cautious conservative type. Just because a lot of logistical things go into it, you know, breaking down up there could be tough. People are usually very, very helpful because they understand that, hey, this could be me. Southeast, I run into that a lot just with boats, because if you see a bear from your boat, you got to anchor and then you got to take your inflatable from the boat to the shore. And I like to solo hunt, but that's just a lot of extra stuff that I don't really want to do. If, you know, if I slip getting out of my boat, trying to get into my raft, you know, and so, it just, you just really got to take, those sort of things into consideration. But again, you know, pushing yourself and getting beyond your comfort level, not to a place where you're overwhelmed and you're being an idiot.
Right.
You know, like, man, that's, I would love to do the same. I want to go up there and I want to do the Hall Road archery for sure. There's so much to do.
What unit did you say? So I'm looking at the hunting unit map, the GMUs. So I'm looking at Anchorage is in 14. You got Fairbanks in 20.
Yeah, the if you head up, you see 11. The road 11. Yep. Sorry, not the, uh-huh. the management unit, but 11. It crosses the Yukon River, and then are you on Onyx? Are you on the Google or what?
Oh no, I was actually looking. I was on Alaska Fishing Game.
Okay, yeah,
looking at the GMUs.
24A. And then if you take that up and over the Brooks Range to 26B.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's some country there.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah. So folks that you know are listening that can't see any of this, we're talking, you know, that's 26 is that's northern Alaska.
Yeah, I mean, that's above the Arctic Circle.
Yeah.
That's 500 miles as the crow flies from Anchorage, so that's that's like, well, it's 400, 500 miles. That's, oops, my distance here. That's 500 miles is Seattle to almost Sacramento. So the entire, that's like driving from just north of Sacramento all the way up to Seattle. Like that's what we're talking about. And that's a big part of the state, but that's not even all of it. And that's the only road you have. It's unfathomable how much space there is up here.
Well, you know what? And so I just pulled it up on Google Maps, right? And shame on me for not ever doing that before. But man, I mean, you take Alaska and if you, you know, air quote, cut it out of your map and then you overlaid that you're talking, you know, a state that's going to stretch from the Pacific coast to probably the edge of Wyoming, touching North Dakota, South Dakota, and then all the way from our northern border to our southern border. I mean, it is massive.
It's pretty out of control. If you include the Aleutian Chain, you could have Southeast Alaska and Florida, and then the Aleutian Chain, which goes all the way into the other time zone.
Like, yeah,
that would be in California. Like, it's just an absolutely massive. Which, you know, going back to our discussions about management and whatnot, if you have Prince of Wales Island, which is where I grew up, it's Unit 2, that island is the third largest island in the United States, has about 6,000 people on it. It's densely forested. It's Southeast Alaska rainforest. And yet there's wolves that are they're trying to get on the endangered species list. And the first thing we need to do is figure out, well, how many wolves do we have? We don't even know. And even if people were allowed to trap as liberally as they wanted to, it would be impossible to trap them into extinction. So, but it's that applying that down south logic to something that people don't know about. They know that, you know, in California there's no wolves, and it's sad. And there were no wolves in the Yellowstone area. There's very few, and so look, it's recovering. Like, well, it's not possible to trap out the wolves on Prince of Wales. I have buddies that are trappers and they get some, but those things are so stinking smart. The land is so dense, the forest is so thick, and there's so few roads, it's just not gonna happen. Then you go up north, totally different climate, because if Southeast Alaska would be like a Florida, then you're talking about, you know, Nebraska, South Dakota. You know, it's just such a massive swing. And difference, you can get, it's like different worlds.
Yeah. It's amazing when you actually look at it like that. I would have never put it together like that with that map zoomed out, right? As I'm looking at zones, I'm looking at Alaska, and then I backed that thing out of Google Maps and it was like, whoa.
Yeah.
Put it in perspective.
Yeah.
How is that contrast, man, since you spent time down here? How is the contrast from like being here in California and then being there in Alaska, growing up in Alaska and then looking and visiting, you know, air quote, the outside world? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of what, you know, folks know about Alaska is, again, on the TV shows we see.
yeah. About that. We moved up to Alaska when I was 5. My parents got teaching jobs. Uh-huh. And my parents made a point to take us south every summer just so that when my brother and I graduated high school, we weren't intimidated by the real world, that we could function down there. And so college in Arizona was fun. And then I would go back home every summer. And then California, I had a good time there. You know, it was different, but I'd come home every summer and I'd fish for 2.5 months. So it seemed like it was perfect. I could live down there during the year. I had a great job teaching, loved it. And then come home during the summer. It was perfect. But, you know, then it becomes, you know, I kind of want to live year round up there. So I never really was intimidated by the lower 48 because of the travel. And so living there didn't seem like that big of a deal. And when you grow up in a spot where there's a ton of rain, 120 inches a year, you get curious about the outside world and you kind of want to get out and see what the rest of the world's like. And so I was excited to be out at first. And then after a while you think, well, am I going to be here forever? Because if not, then I should move. Otherwise I'm going to accidentally be here forever and just wonder what it would have been like if I would have moved back. But there are things I miss about down there. You know, I miss good chicken wings. It's mostly food related stuff that I'm like, oh gosh, it'd be great right now. But I don't miss the traffic or the pollution or things like that but I have that level of comparison, you know, like I can see the best here and I've been through a lot of winters, so I know what to expect.
I'm not gonna even ask that.
What?
I was gonna say, so what's the global warming look like up there?
Man, it's so weird. When you get people to see things through a specific lens, then they see things through a specific lens. And so you're not sure, well, is this really it? Or is this just me not telling the difference? But, you know, we're seeing it with one of our biggest issues, where we're asking where the king salmon are going and where they've been. One of my journalism students is doing an article on the King Salmon Derby that there used to be in the leaderboard. There was, you know, the top 15 of the top 20 fish were above 50 pounds, you know, 60 pounds, and the winner would be 70 or so. But now, you know, your winners are in the 50s and there's a lot smaller fish, and where are the huge fish and why are there fewer fish? And so looking at the trawling industry that just absolutely destroys everything in the bottom of the ocean, and they can't keep king salmon or halibut. And so all that stuff is bycatch and it's just killed and wasted. And so, like, is that messing it up? Is it ocean acidification? Is it the spawning grounds are bad? So there's a lot of things that are going on as possible, you know, what is it? You know, some people can reduce it to like global warming and, you know, climate change, that the world always does stuff. You know, what can we do about it? It's just not sure, but there definitely been some erosion issues up north. There's been some warmer winters and hot summers, you know, have kind of impacted the tundra up north. And so it's, you know, it's there. What can we do about it? I don't know. And the only stories you hear are about those sort of things. And it can get real depressing really quick if you ask everybody for their little opinion on that.
Oh yeah, you focus in on it, like you said, man. It's like, oosh.
Yeah, well, there's no question that there are some things that are happening. It's just the degree that humans are impacting that. You know, people want to believe that humans are solely responsible and we could totally eradicate it if we do this. But a lot of times, that's just like a crisis entrepreneur trying to make some sort of, you know, or right, power or money some. Based on that. So,
and I think that, you know, and I'm no expert, but you know, the earth goes through cycles.
Yeah.
It has, and I think it's not going to stop. And yeah, we've probably increased or expedited some of that, but yeah. Man.
Yeah. And that should be like an answer that's accepted. Right. And, mm-hmm. But it just becomes, as soon as you say earth goes through cycles, they like cut you off. Oh, you're a denier. You don't like science. It's like, no. You didn't listen to the whole statement. You heard what you wanted to hear. And then you went from there. But I think humans, we've definitely had a massive impact. You just look at the, you know, that glob or that floating fortress of plastic that's out in the Pacific Ocean.
Oh,
it's like, it's unbelievable. Like there's no denying that we have totally jacked this stuff up, but to get people to buy in the fact that we can totally reverse it or change this if you elect this or if you do this policy, like I want to help, but I'm hesitant about what you would do with this power and this control.
Yeah. Well, and you know what, it's funny. And you kind of said it there, right? Is, and I don't know what it is. You got to be on one side or the other nowadays,
yeah.
Right? You can't, there's no middle ground with it, right? Either you believe this way or you believe that way. If not, I don't even want to talk to you. We're not going to solve any of it that way. You know, none of it, none of the problems are going to get solved that way. Yeah. And I think that's half the issue with it all. And that's why it sits in this, it seems like a perpetual limbo.
Yeah.
Like, well, what's the, you know, we're focused on the problems, but we don't, at least from where I'm sitting, I haven't, it's like, what's the solution? Where are the solutions at? Because we're bantering back and forth on problems all the time.
Yeah.
What's our solution to these things?
And when people talk about compromise, what they mean is you need to see it from my perspective. You need to do all the compromise. Yes, it's like, well, come that's on it. Now. Yep. Come on.
Yeah. That's a great marriage.
Yeah, exactly.
Imagine living like that. Goodness.
Oh. And it goes back to, you know, having some sort of point, like what's your main purpose in your existence? Is your main purpose to go online and try to win at social media or find an identity and being the angry person who tells it like it is, you know, or do you have something else in your life that brings joy? Because if we don't allow happiness, if we don't allow joy, because you need to be concerned about all these bad things that are happening, and if you're not upset, you don't care. Well, then what are we trying to work toward? Mm-hmm. We have to allow joy. We can't allow people to just say, you should be angry, you should be upset, and allow corporations and allow people to make us always upset, because then we can't help the people who are around us, right? Yep. The people that we encounter daily. And that's got to be an important thing, but it's not part of the conversation a lot.
Well, you kind of relate, at least in this pea brain of mine, you are what you eat, right? Mm-hmm. And if we're consuming negative all the time, that's the outlook, you know. And on the other side of that, you know, the happy flowers and sugar plums and act like nothing's wrong is our meal, then that's what we're eating. But it's like, man, that, you know, there's this happy middle ground with all of it. And I think that's where we're struggling to find ourselves. If that makes any sense, it did in my head.
No, I'm right there with you. And you know, again, going back to social media connecting us with positive people, you find out how many other people like can have this conversation. You know,
mm-hmm.
We've had this conversation for an hour and 15 minutes or whatever it is now, but and we haven't talked previously, right? It's just been, oh, guy seems like a pretty good dude. Let's talk on the podcast. But we've been able to go back and forth and agree on stuff, even though we've never met. And that just kind of gives mm-hmm. you hope that there's a lot of people who are sick of the divisive people on the far right and far left that are ruining it for everybody else.
I'm glad you said far right and left, because that's where people go wrong.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
That's exactly what we're saying. So you guys take that one to heart, right? just because it's on that side, then, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of, I mean, how often do you see that, right? All those, you know, people over here are just all jacked up. And it's like, okay, I get it, right? I understand what you're saying, but there's nobody that's 100% free and clear in these arguments.
Yeah.
It is, I don't know, man.
Oof. I was hiking in Wyoming this last summer. We're doing a backpacking trip, and for some stupid reason, I was thinking about like political profiles and stuff online. And then because you're passing people, you just kind of wonder, you know, what did they post? What are they doing here? Whatnot? And I started thinking about, man, what if someone twisted their ankle, but I'd seen them in the parking lot and I saw their bumper sticker and think, oh, serves you right for spreading your ankle because you voted for, you know, and whoever.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, would we treat people that badly? Our instinct probably would be to help. Like, hey, can you take a picture of my fiance and I? Sure, absolutely. Hey, you know, you're just helping people out. That's the natural sort of instinct when you're in person. Mm-hmm. But then we see someone with the wrong bumper sticker, then just, oh, you're one of those types. It's like, dude, no. A half hour ago, you were willing to help. You know, you took a good picture of me and you asked if this was okay. Like, thank you. You know, we were just nice. We said good morning. But then it all changes because of something else? That's stupid.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense, man. That's like, I'm at my wit's end with the corona thing, with the mask and all that, right? And there's absolute situations, right? And I'm going to say Alaska is probably one of them. My daughter was in Hawaii. She moved over to Hawaii. That was the place that, as you know, when she was a young teen, she dreamed of living. She moved over there after she graduated and got a gig, and Hawaii shut down with corona. And I mean, you want to talk about shut down? It shut down.
Yeah.
So she, you know, she said, I got to get out of here. Moved out of there, whatever. I could totally understand it. But you're talking, we're here on the mainland. We have the resources. People are, you know, getting their vaccinations, wearing their mask. If you don't have that mask on, and it doesn't matter if you've been vaccinated or not, people will look at you like you are walking around spreading, you know, like you're dead tomorrow. It is crazy.
Yeah, it just got politicized so early. It became a divisive, you either honor team or not, and that's the power grab that was there. And then when you had politicians who were, it was just so clear that rules apply to us and they don't apply to them. And it was on both sides. You know, it was just, I've never felt so cynical and so distrusting of of that at the national level. I think at the local level, when you have people who know the communities, and I think your local representatives, that's a lot different than some of the people who are, you know, back in Washington. But yeah, it definitely brought out the worst in us for sure.
I think that might be a little different for you guys, because when I see it here, man, and you look at, you know, the one-sided, hey, you do what I am, what I'm telling you to do, but not what I'm doing type thing that they were pulling here. And it was beyond disappointing.
Yeah,
beyond disappointing, right? And I don't know if you guys see any of that mess up there, you know, via the news. But you know, hey, you're on lockdown, and there's, you know, full-fledged birthday parties and dinners that politicians are having here. And it's just like, you know, what's good for the goose isn't good for the gander, buddy. Like, how are you know, how are you leading if that's what you're supposed to do? It just, I don't know.
Yeah.
I guess, I don't look for those guys as leaders, but it was sad here. Yeah. I mean, it was disturbing, some of the local officials.
When it first happened, everything was on lockdown. People in Ketchikan were worried because we're an island community. And so we thought, well, it might be great because being that Alaska Airlines wasn't having a lot of flights coming in, so we might be able to kind of escape this. But then we thought, man, what if it does get here? Seattle was overwhelmed, and if we have critical cases that can't be helped at the hospital here in Ketchikan, Seattle wasn't taking any new people. And so there was the fear of, gosh, if we get overwhelmed, there's no place for us to go.
Right.
And this is, again, this was April, May, June, and we went a month and a half where we had 16 total cases, and they were all recovered. So May looked kind of different because it was sunny and it was warm and it was nice and there was no school and there was no one coming up. And so our economy was, you know, we were expecting a million passengers off cruise ships last summer. And with all the cruise ships canceled, it was a huge shock. But then some of the people who had their, you know, nice 26-foot boats that they charter in, they're like, all right, well, it's time to take the family out. So for some people, it ended up being this just refreshing, I get to enjoy Ketchikan and Alaska with my family when it's nice and warm and I'm not waking up at 3 a.m. to go guide for, you know, 20 days in a row. And so some people who are able to financially make it through, it was kind of a healthy summer because it was, wow, you know, there's no bubble, you know, it's just you and your family, but you're going out getting crab and shrimp and camping and bonfires on the beach. And, you know, you didn't have that same lockdown level. There were people who were very, demonstrative when it came to the masks, but I didn't really see much of that. You know, I want to say that it was way better, but I know that there were some pockets that weren't good, and I'm sure there was a lot of things that I didn't see. But, you know, it was pretty nice because I think people, they weren't as impacted by it. I think had it been a lockdown, total misery, more anxiety, I think it would have been a lot worse. But because people had outlets and the style of life here can be different, where if I'm upset, I can go on a hike and I can kind of walk it off, or I can do something that brings enjoyment to my life. So we didn't have, it wasn't as nasty. It has been nasty at times, but, you know, based on what I saw, it wasn't just day in, day out nasty as it was in some areas.
You know, you said it right with families going and, you know, having the bonfires. That's one thing. And as bad as that stuff was, and as much as a burden as it was, to see the amount of people in the outdoors recreating, doing things here as families, that there was huge, I don't care who you are, there was huge value in the coronavirus with that. Because, man, our mountains didn't close. You know, beaches might have been closed, but to see entire groups of, you know, people out there just enjoying the outdoors with each other and enjoying each other and seeing those bonds, and not just seeing them, but hearing, man, I spent so much time with the kids, or we did this and we did that. There's some huge value that came out of that, man. And I hope that people realize and value that a little bit more, right? Because we're in a time and place where we are, our connection is through the blue screen, whatever it is, TV, the telephones, computer, and we don't have that. Our interpersonal relationships are not face to face.
Yeah. Well, you didn't have to go to, you know, your 5-year-old son's soccer practice or your 5-year-old daughter's soccer practice. It was, all right, family's at home now. Let's have a old fashioned barbecue. Let's spend time together. And that's, you know, you weren't so busy, and then you found out what was really important. And a lot of the times the stuff that we think is important or we spend a lot of time on isn't really the stuff that's most important. But
I just hope, again, I hope that folks reflect on that, you know, and don't get too excited about whatever, you know, getting back to normal means, whatever their normalcy or whatever that looks like now, and forget, you know, that time and how valuable that was, man.
Yeah.
It's an amazing thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully it's not going back to the old normal, because that was a very unhealthy thing. And I think a lot of people were exposed or felt exposed by their health, their diet, their mental health, their, you know, exercise levels. And, you know, if I have pre-existing conditions or if I have any control over my health, then I need to do something about it, because that puts me more at risk. And I don't want to be in the at-risk category if I can do something about it. I think there's people who have used that as motivation going forward and have changed their lives because, hey, I don't want to be in that area. I don't want to be the at-risk group. I want to be in a different group. I want to be able to not have to rely on the vaccine or doctors. I want to do everything I can to put myself in a position to be healthy.
I wonder if that creature of habit, right, when this lightens up and the threat is away and our complacency builds, if we'll be looking at a cycle again, because people don't remember that. Yeah. Right. We forget very easy, right, when it's something, you know, fearful or something smacks us and, you know, right across the face. Once we get back to those comforts, and that's a lot of what I see is people wanting, you know, that air quote comfort back, what they see as comfort. are they going to stay focused on those things?
Yeah.
That's the scary part.
Yeah. We had the perfect excuse to get your stuff together.
Yeah.
And I mean, what are you going to do? Ask for anything more. Like, obviously we didn't ask that, and it'd be nice if we didn't have to have these sort of jolts. But if there's any reason for someone to follow through with like a New Year's resolution, then this year was definitely the year to appreciate people, to appreciate life, to make the most of it. And hopefully a lot of people stuck with it.
Yeah, that'd be huge, man, to see folks come out of this and, you know, be better, stay better, and continue to grow from it. Mm-hmm. At least that's, I don't know, I could have a warm and fuzzy hope, right?
Yep, for sure. Have to.
That's the hard part, man. Well, shoot, brother. I appreciate the time. I appreciate the ask and getting on and shooting it with you. It's kind of a little oddball, you know, going back and forth, sharing the episode on the same episode. It's interesting.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, hopefully it'll like introduce our listeners to a new perspective, and then yeah, I think it'll be good.
Why don't you drop where folks can get you? Let's talk about the book real quick, man.
Okay.
Do this. Give us a little bit about the podcast and then talk about the book, because I'm interested in that.
Okay. Started the podcast 2017 just to kind of talk about Alaska. I wanted people from Alaska telling the Alaska story, because a lot of people come up here, and it's great. I love watching excited people who come up. They made it work, and they're either doing DIY or going out with a guide, and they're just loving Alaska. It's great to see it. But also I wanted to provide that voice of someone who lives here year-round and all the other things, and talk to other Alaskans who might not be the guides or the popular people, and to really do something about the reality TV show and bring some actual reality. and then as far as the book goes, it was kind of the same thing. I meant to write 5,000 words per month last year. So it'd be a 60,000 word book, just a month by month look at what life is like in Ketchikan. And so I wrote each month during the month, and at the end of the month I finished it. And so there's no benefit of hindsight. So it was just, you know, steelhead fishing, and then, you know, dealing with the darkness and all that sort of stuff, and black ice. And then March happens, and then all of a sudden it becomes a little bit about teaching during a pandemic. And so it's just a time capsule of 2020 through the eyes of a teacher, outdoors person who lives in Ketchikan. And it was a lot of fun. But then when I was editing in, you know, January, I looked back at some of the stuff I wrote, and I was like, but you know, that's what I felt. So I'm not going to change it. You know, that's what I felt in April, or that's what I felt in June or July. And so it's probably 80% just outdoors and 20%, you know, kind of dealing with the pandemic. So yeah, it was fun. Proud of it. Best stuff I've ever written. So I'm pretty excited to share it with people.
Where can they grab it?
You can buy it on Amazon, or you can go to amiserableparadise.com, get it there. And there's a bookstore in Ketchikan and Juneau. Juneau is Rainy Retreat Books. Ketchikan is Parnassus, and it will be available at Mosquito Books up in Anchorage in the near future. And you can follow me at Alaska Lund on Instagram, or the Mediocre Alaskan on Instagram. That's also the name of the podcast. The Mediocre Alaskan.
Excellent, man.
How about you? Give me yours.
Man, mine's easy. Western Contours on Instagram, westerncontours.com. You know, for the website, that'll kind of, there's a little backstory there. I'm bad on updating my website, and I got to get better on that. And then I started a brand called, actually, I might have to, send you some, man, and let you put it to the Alaskan test. Western fly covers late last year, and just right now doing pack flies and vinyl harness flies. So I might have to kick some. So I had both up there last year on that caribou hunt, and they did really good on that hunt. So
yes,
we'll have to get them in the hands of an Alaskan and check them out, man.
I'll do the water test for sure.
Oh yeah, they did really good when they were up there.
Good.
So I was pretty happy with it. But yeah, Western Contours, and then, you know, the podcast is on just about every major platform there is. So
cool. Awesome, man. Thanks. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I do too, man. It was we'll have to do this again, man. I'll go one sided because I really want to get into some of that Alaskan hunting and talk fishing and stuff with you too up there. I'm pretty curious. We'll have to get a part two coming up.
I'm down.
Good deal. All right, brother.
Take care, man.
Thank you.